It's my pleasure to introduce Kay S., who's our speaker this evening. Kay and her husband, Eddie Lee, go to the Howe Place, which is up in Cherokee County, Woodstock, right off of Bells Ferry Road. That's where the meeting place that I've been going to. And I heard Kay's story several years ago, and I was very impressed because of the fact that she delivers a fun and enjoyable story, but she also has a good story of recovery and working this program. And she can tell you she's been in this program for a while and has some time. And it's sort of like the T-shirts, like Sam's got on, that we had for the Spring Fling. We're not a glum lot. We may have chosen to not pick up a drink today, but we still have fun. And so with that, I would ask you to welcome KS.
Wow, thank you. My name's Kay. I'm an alcoholic. And an overeater and a drug addict. And I have several of those things. I want to thank John for asking me to do this. He asked me quite some time ago, and several conflicts had gotten in the way. So it's been on the schedule for several months. And he treated us to a really nice dinner at the Cheesecake Factory at Cumberland. And we live in Rockmart, so, you know, where the cars are on blocks and the homes are on wheels out where we live. And we were just like, wow, look at this place. You know, it's beautiful. You see an article in the paper tomorrow that the Clampets have hit Cumberland. That may have been us. So now I'm glad to be here. Glad y'all are here. One of the things that I kind of like to do it's the thing that helped me qualify myself for this program. I had drank for 20 years, but I knew I had a problem with alcohol. I did not think I was an alcoholic, even though I drank for 20 years. My dad had died from alcoholism when I was 14 years old. I'd sworn that I would never turn out to be like my father. And so when I got to AA, the hardest thing for me was to say, I'm an alcoholic, because to say that, I'm saying I'm just like Daddy. You know, I didn't live up to my vow that I took at 14 years old. And I always tell people, you know, I drank for 20 years and didn't really have a problem. I was sober 6 months and became an alcoholic, you know. Some of you know what I'm talking about. So what helped me to qualify myself was I heard a guy read the promises like this. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, I would be amazed before I was halfway through. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, I knew a new freedom and a new happiness. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, I would not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, I could comprehend the word serenity and I would know peace. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, no matter how far down the scale I went, I could see how my experience could benefit others. Some of you can relate. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, that feeling of uselessness and self-pity would disappear and then reappear and then disappear. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, I would lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in my fellows. My daughter's here. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, self-seeking would slip away. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, my whole attitude and outlook upon life would change. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, fear of people and of economic insecurity would leave me. Used to sit home and contemplate future job opportunities. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, I would intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle me. My sponsor says I know how to intuitively baffle situations I used to handle now that I'm sober. And here's the biggie. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, I would suddenly realize that alcohol was doing for me what I could not do myself. So if you can relate to that, maybe you're in the right place tonight. But I'm supposed to tell you what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. I'll try not to stay, you know, drunk too long. I always like to get sober by about 8:30 and move on to recovery. I mean, I don't mean figuratively, not literally, but I don't know if John told y'all I used to do stand-up comedy, and he's been telling everybody tonight, oh, she was a comedian, she was a comedian. People are like, well, that better be funny. And I'm like, well, you better write me a check, because I don't work for free. But now, I was actually born in rural Georgia, which back when Alpharetta was actually considered a rural area. And I was born in Duluth, Georgia, grew up in Alpharetta, and my dad, I always say Alpharetta at that time, had two traffic lights, about three cops, and one town drunk, who I used to call Daddy. And my dad used to drive drunk through the center of town, and he was a member. My mother and father were members of the American Legion Auxiliary, which, if you're familiar with that, I always thought the Legion was an acronym for let everyone get intoxicated or numb, and that's what they did. And but my dad would, we would see people, the cops or whoever, the next week or the next night, and they would ask, you know, did Jane make it home okay? The other night we followed him to the edge of town, you know, and then just let him go, you know. And we lived 6 miles north of Alpharetta, and but, you know, that was our life. Daddy drank, and we tried to fix him. You know, that was my life growing up. My mother used to tell us that we would try, she would say, well, we're going to try this. I'm going to get a bottle of whiskey, because Daddy only drank beer. And she'd say, I will get a bottle of whiskey, and we'll all gargle in it. And when he comes home, we'll smell like alcohol. And then we'll stagger around and act like we're drunk, and we'll show him what it's like to live with a bunch of drunks, you know. I know now Daddy would have just been like, party, you know. I mean, it's like that's going to bother him if his 8 and 12-year-old are liquored up, you know. Wouldn't have bothered him a bit. But like I said, Daddy always drank beer. And so I had my first drink of alcohol at about 8 or 9 years old. My mother, I had bronchitis, and my mother soaked a tablespoon of sugar in whiskey and gave it to me as cough syrup. And they were already giving me codeine cough syrup, you know, and they said, well, if she coughs in between, you can give her a dose of whiskey, you know. And I hated that stuff. I mean, I would cough and spit and hack and gag and say, ugh, don't give me that stuff again. And then I would fake coughing to get her to... And I remember my... I remember my brother saying, she's faking. I'm like, no, I'm not. You know, and she'd stick another spoon in my mouth. So I actually feel like I brought an alcoholic to my first drink, because to me, that's the phenomenon of craving. Your mind is saying, no, 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 that tastes awful. But your body is saying, yes, 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 I need more. I need more. And so I started, that was my beginning, I guess, was just as cough syrup. But I picked up a drink on my own at 14 years old, 2 months after my dad died from an overdose of alcohol. Now, this was 1976, and alcoholism was not talked about. It was something to be very ashamed of. It was not something that was AA. I never even remember hearing mentioned. I remember the doctors telling him if he didn't quit drinking, he was going to die, and he would just go and drink more. And but so this was 1976. 2 months after my father died, I picked up my first drink, thinking, I'll never turn out to be like my daddy. And I always say, you know, with a bottle in one hand and one hand to God, I said, I'll never turn out to be like my dad. And 20 years later, I put the bottle down and with both hands to God said, you know, God help me. Because the only thing I had done different from my dad in 20 years of drinking was that I had not died from it yet, and I never drank Miller High Life beer. Because that's what he drank. And you know the mindset, that's the problem. It's that Miller High Life. It's not all this other stuff. You know, just stay away from that and you'll be all right. And that's, you know, that's the way we think. It's like the story a friend of mine tells, the story about an alcoholic drive his car into a tree and get out and go, I need to quit driving. I right? A drug addict will drive the same car into the same tree and get out and bust out laughing and say, it's not my car, I don't care. And a codependent Allen, untreated Al-Anon will go out there the next day and cut that tree down saying, you'll never cause this to happen again. It's the tree's fault. That's what it is. So that was my, you know, that was my experience. I drank different things. I switched, you know, that page in the big book that says we switched and switched and switched, taking a trip, not taking a trip. I love that. That's on a bumper sticker. You just got to love that. Not just taking a trip, not taking a trip. It, you know, whether the sky is blue or the sky is gone or the sky is there, you know, I had to have something to numb out reality. And I can do that even still today, stone cold sober. You know, it's not drugs or alcohol anymore. But I remember going through a time frame when my stepdad of 18 years died in 1999. And, you know, my daddy died at 14. My mother remarried when I was about 18 or 19. And so this man had been my dad for all of my adult life. And when he was re-diagnosed with pancreatic cancer in 1998 and early 99, I started reading John Grisham novels like they were, you know, like some kind of drug or something. I would stand and cook supper. I had a baby in the little carrier thing in the kitchen. I would stand and cook supper while I'm reading this book, you know, anything to escape reality. I'll never forget finishing the book that I was reading and going down to Kmart at 9:30 at night because they were getting ready to close and Street Lawyer just came out in paperback, you know. You know, give me another book. Give me another book. Just like I did when I was drinking, you know. I mean, just anything to escape. And so that's what this program helps me to, you know, try to stay on track. But I started, like I said, I started drinking when I was 14. I got married right out of high school, you know, married the first alcoholic that I could find. And, of course, I always saw that as, you know, he had the problem and I'm going to fix him. You know, I've got so many issues. But I was, you know, here she comes to save the day. All he needs is a good woman. Yeah, well, is he hooked up with you? So I, you know, was going to fix him. And that was a very violent situation and finally got out of that about 6 years later. And 4 years later, turned right around and did it again. And 4 months later, got out of that one. Everybody was like, well, didn't you want to give it more time? I gave it 3 months and 30 days too long. It was, and I could write a book, you know you're an alcoholic when you're moving out from your marriage and you've got chips from the reception that are still fresh. I am not kidding. There were nachos chips that had not been opened, and they were still crunchy when the day I moved out. So, to give you an idea. so that was in 1990, and I decided at that point, you know, several things were kind of pointing me in the direction of, you know, the only common denominator that had been in any of the bad jobs or the bad relationships or the bad scenarios, the only common denominator in all of those was me. So I thought, well, maybe I need to get some help. So I go to therapy and, you know, go and lie to the therapist. So you drink? Oh, no, hardly ever. And so I did the therapy thing. There was a lot of abuse in my childhood, which I won't get into that. But, you know, for years I thought, well, that's why I drank, because these people abused me. And, you know, that's happened to a lot of other people that made different choices. They didn't choose to drink. So I think I drank because I was an alcoholic. That was just, you know, a part of my story was that there was other abuse in my background. And I kept blaming it, you know, well, if you had this happen to you, you know, you'd drink too. So I went to therapy for a few years and then decided that wasn't working enough. So geographical change, that'll do it. So I moved to Savannah. And, you know, if you drink, God help you, that's the place you don't want to be. Or rather, maybe the place you do want to be is in Savannah. I mean, it is just a drinking city. And so that was in 1993, and it was sometime around the early part of 91 that I started realizing I was starting to have some health problems, probably from drinking, but I was having a lot of indigestive system problems and all this stuff, and still, of course, lying to the doctors, oh, no, I don't drink. But I thought that it was the job, and I was in a very stressful job scenario. And so one of the ladies that I worked with brought me this little ad that was in Creative Loafing for a comedy workshop. And she wrote on it, you know, you're so funny, call this guy or something, you missed your chance, you've missed your calling, that's what she said. So I got mad at work one day, and I went out and partook in some herbal substances and thought, well, I'll call this guy. And I told you my daughter's here. And so I called the workshop hotline or whatever, and, you know, it was $125, and the next morning the water pump blew up on my car, and it was going to cost $110, and I think I had $250 in my checking account. So I wrote the check for the new water pump and wrote the check for the comedy workshop and had like $10 or $20 left till payday. Because that just sounded like the thing to do, is go take this class on stand-up comedy, because, you know, that was just the thing to do. And so I did, and that was July of 1991, and by the summer of the next year, I was starting to be offered a lot of work and starting to have to juggle my day job with this new night job that I was trying to get. So I always tell everybody, I quit my day job, sold everything I owned, quit my day job, put that $200 in the bank, everything I sold. Some of you will get that at the meeting in the morning and go, oh, that's, she had nothing worth anything. That's what it was. So I put all that money in the bank and had a few weeks of work on the books, and I rented a room out of this lady's house, and I hit the road. Well, very early on in my comedy career, you know, there's a lot of drinking that goes on in comedy clubs, and comedians are given drink tickets at the beginning of the week. You get anywhere from 10 to 20 to unlimited drinks. I could drink unlimited here at the Atlanta Punchline because that was my home club. So I got thinking, well, maybe I shouldn't drink because I could become an alcoholic, you know, not even realizing that I'd already been drinking for quite a few years at this point. One of the jobs that I used to have in Buckhead, I worked right on Lenox Road at Peachtree across from Phipps and Lenox Square, and we used to go to the bucket shop all the time right after work. Well, the company that I worked for was an international software company, and I just happened to befriend the woman who had the keys to the executive liquor closet. And so I'd go up there at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, have a little meeting with her, and we'd justify, you know, a drink because, you know, we're an international software company. It's 5 o'clock somewhere. So we'd we'd start drinking at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and she'd shut down the liquor closet at about 11 that night, and then we'd stagger over to the bucket shop till about 12 or 1, and sometimes even go on to Studebaker's and continue this. And I would match her drink for drink this whole time and get in my car and think, whew, Pam needs to quit drinking. She is an alcoholic. So here I am now, it's 1992, and I'm in stand-up comedy, and I'm thinking, wow, if I drink all these drink tickets, I could become an alcoholic. So I started managing that with other things that God put on this green earth, and started managing it that way, and thought that I had everything under control, and I would go for periods of time, periods of months and months even, without a drink. But not even a moment. If I woke up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, I'd have to light. And so that went on, you know, I got sober in 1995, so this was 92, so I was pretty much 24/7 something. And I used to say, oh, I can quit that stuff anytime my dealer runs out. That's when I just put that stuff aside. Every time she ran out, I would quit that and go back to drinking temporarily. But every time there toward the end of my drinking career, every time I drank, Whereas I used to could drink any man under the table, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9. Back in the day, it was 2 for 1 and 3 for 1, you know, and I could have 2 or 3 or 4 rounds of that and get up, walk straight line out of the bar. Those days were gone. By 1994, 95 time frame, I could drink one drink and be buzzed and not stop. You know, I think I was drinking for that effect, you know. What used to take 10 or 12 to get that effect now only took one. I'd swear, I'm only going to have one. That's all I want is one. I'm only going to get one. Did I mention I'm only going to have one? You know, and 6, 7, 8, 9 later. And that's what happened the last year of my drinking in 1995. My actual last big drunk was Friday the 13th, January 1995. And all I will say about that night is that the next day, I know what that phrase, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, means. And that's all I'll say about that, as Forrest Gump would say. I know what that means. I experienced that. I lived that. And I swore then I'll never, never do this again. And I moved back to Atlanta. I was living in Savannah, working at a club. I was working at a comedy club in Columbia, South Carolina. I was actually managing the club. And the owner and I were starting to really butt heads because I was trying to pull away and go on the road and do more stand-up. And he wanted me to stay there and do more management. And so we were starting to butt heads. And so I knew I needed to get out of Columbia, so I gave him my notice, and I was going to head back to Savannah for about 4 weeks. My end of the lease was up, and I'm going to move back to Atlanta. There again, geographical change. That'll make it better. Unfortunately, everywhere I went, there I was. Therein lied the problem. So in February of 95, I moved back to Atlanta, and I had so much work booked at that time, I really didn't have to find a place to live until April. Well, come April of 95, I found I rented a room out of this lady's house, found her through the newspaper, and went over there for the interview, and she said, "Do you drink?" No, I quit that stuff. In fact, they gave me a bottle of rum for a going-away present, and because she said, "Well, I don't care if you do, I do." She said, "I just want to make sure you don't have a problem." "Oh, no, I don't have a problem. You drink. I just don't need to drink." So I said, "Oh, in fact, they gave me a going-away bottle of Bacardi rum. I'll just give it to you." And she's like, "Okay, cool, you know." And would you know, a month later, I was tearing the house apart looking for that bottle of Bacardi rum. Do you know she had the nerve to drink that bottle of Bacardi rum I gave her? So I hit one of those slumps where I didn't have anything else, so I needed that bottle, you know. And I walked in there, and when I couldn't find it, because, you know, she had to go and drink it, I walked in there, and I smoked Virginia Slim 120. It'd take you like an hour and a half to smoke one of them things. I walked in the living room. I was like, "Do you know what time that liquor store closes down the road? I think I'm going to go get me stuff, make me a White Russian. I just want one White Russian. That's all I want. Did I mention I only want one White Russian? That's all I'm going to get. But I'm going to buy all the stuff to make a bunch of White Russians. But I'm only going to drink one." She's, "Oh, they don't close till 11. I said, "Oh, okay. Well, I think I'll run down there." So I smoked that cigarette for about 45 minutes. Got down there, and they were closed. They closed at 10 o'clock, and I remember sitting there in that parking lot. Now, this is April of 95. I'm not sober yet till September, but I've had this horrible experience in January. You know, I wasn't ever going to drink again, and I'm sitting outside a liquor store beating my hands on the steering wheel, cursing this woman for telling me the wrong time, and then looked across the street, and there's Kroger. My best friend. They sell beer and wine at Kroger, you know. So I go over there and I get this big old jug of wine. It's gone. It's like a friend of mine says, "Bottle caps are for shipping." Oh, won't be needing that, you know. So I drank the whole bottle. Yeah, I went through another period of, "Oh, gosh, that's awful. I'll never do that again. Oh, I feel awful. I'll never do that again." And so I continue on and into the summer. And at this point, every time I turned around, I was working with another comedian that was in this program. Oh, my gosh. That is the worst thing you can do to an active alcoholic, is stick one of you people in a car. talking about God and praying and turning your life over and your will. And I'm like, yeah, I'm turning my life over as soon as I get you out of my car. And as soon as I get back to the Cafe 290, I'm turning my life over to whatever. But as God would have it, every other gig I did was with somebody in this program. So we come up to August of 95, and now it's my belly button birthday, and I'm working at, I was in town for a few weeks, so I was working as a temp at Equifax. I hope none of y'all work there. I somehow skated by that whole drug screening and alcohol screening thing. So I was working as a temp there, and some guys that I used to work with called me up, remembered my birthday, we're going to take you out to a Mexican restaurant. I was like, okay, I'll go, but I'm not going to drink, okay? I'm just not going to drink. I had a bad experience in January, another bad experience in April. I'm not going to drink. They were like, whatever, you know, and 30 minutes in the door, I'm ordering a CC and 7. Could you put it in a real tall glass? Because maybe it won't hurt me then if you put it in a real tall glass, you know, 22 ounces of 7-Up. Surely that 1 ounce of liquor won't hurt me. It hurt me, you know, because I had 6 22-ounce glasses and an iron kidney later. I'm sitting there drunk and angry because I'm drunk. And then I'm driving home drunk, and I go home and change out of my little zoot suit that I had worn to Equifax, and thought, you know, I can go to the Punchline and drink more for free. Why did I want to go drink more? I was already drunk, you know, mission accomplished. And I got home, and my roommate had left me a cake and a little, this is some pathetic thing, birthday cake with a little candle. They've just come out with those that you light, and it sings happy birthday to you. Not a big fan of those things, because I'm sitting there just lighting the thing, and it's happy birthday to you. And I'm drunk out of my mind, and I woke up the next morning with the cake still sitting there on the ironing board, the lights still on, I'm still in my zoot suit. I came to, I should say, the next morning, and I woke up mad because I passed out and I didn't get to go finish drinking. So I was mad. I was mad at her for leaving me the cake. I was really mad she left the candle, because that was just really pathetic. You know, sitting there playing the little birthday candle to myself. And my best friend at this point was 2 months sober in this program. And I was about at the point I was going to have to shoot her, because she was just so happy. Oh, what, how are you? Oh, just praying about it. Just happy, Kathy. Just... I was like, my life sucks. Well, pray about it. I hate my job. Pray about it. I hate you. Well, pray about it. So I was praying about it one day, and she comes over that day, the day after my belly button birthday, and brings me the little Hazelden 24-hour-a-day book. This is what you want to give a drunk for a birthday. I thought you might. I prayed about it, and I gave you this book. Oh, thank you. And I left town again to go on the road, and I sagged there again. I swear, I just can't do this anymore. I can't drink anymore. I can't drink anymore. And I hit my bottom September 8th, 1995, in Augusta, Georgia. A guy that I was seeing, I had ended the relationship, and he was not a fan of ending the relationship, and he did not want to end the relationship, and he let it be known that he didn't want the relationship to end, and so he started harassing me. Now, this was almost 13 years ago. 12 and a half years ago, when I came bolting through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, September 10th, 1995, in my humble yet accurate opinion, in my magic magnifying mind, he was stalking me. Because there's a lot of drama in our lives. I don't know if any of y'all have noticed this, but we're little chaos junkies, and I have a stalker. I'm so scared I have a stalker. This guy's stalking me. That's all I could talk about. 4 years sober, my new sponsor at the time made me go through a series. She basically tricked me into working a fourth and fifth step again by telling me it was a tenth step. And I don't know if your sponsor's ever done that to you, but kind of ticked me off. And so she kind of locked me in her house in Cartersville one day, and she said, "Tell me about this stalker." She said, "Because you are getting on my very last nerve and jumping up and down on it. Because I don't know about you, but I got to AA because alcohol was kicking my tail. But some reason you got here because of a stalker. That makes you different." And I was like, you know. Well, I didn't mean it to sound like I was different, but he was. He was stalking me. You know, really, what was he doing? Well, he was calling a lot. He called several times a day. 4 years later, 4 years into this program, when I really sat down to look at the truth of what was going on, it was a bad relationship that had gone bad. It was a relationship that had never should have started. It was a relationship where I was going to fix him. All he needs is a good woman, you know, and I'm going to fix him, and he's going to get a, you know, real job, and he's going to, you know, bathe, and he's going to do things. He's going to be respectable. Because I'm, you know, such a good woman. And the truth of it was, he lived in Edgefield, South Carolina, which is about 230 miles from where I lived. He didn't have a car. He didn't have a driver's license. He worked as the French fry guy at the comedy club, making about 180 bucks a week. So it wasn't like he was going to fly in here to kill me. Oh, but the most embarrassing part was he didn't know where I lived. He had never been to my house, and not even sure. And that was before GPS, you know. Where they got, boy, is that a stalker tool right there? It's like, oh, she's on the back porch. Look. I hate those things. So I had to get honest about that. That's what this whole process has been for the last 12-plus years. It's just getting honest about stuff, you know, and getting rid of the drama. You know, I don't like drama anymore. I remember hearing a lady say one time, she's like, she's working with some girls that were in jail, and she said they came to her and said, what am I going to do to have fun in sobriety? And she's like, well, you know, at some point, after you stay here long enough, you'll begin to think that throwing up every day is not any fun. Losing your children to the authorities, that's no fun. Going to court on a regular basis, that's not any fun. Wrecking cars, wrecking lives, you know, doing the things that we do, it's not fun. You know, but that's the first thing we all ask, you know, what am I going to do to have fun? Are you having a blast now? I mean, I've never seen anybody walk into AA going, woohoo, drinking's great. I'm having a blast. How do I quit? You know? So, you know, it's not fun. This is fun. You know, being sober is fun. Waking up and knowing who you are and where your clothes are in your car and, you know, that's fun. I can get a hold of that kind of fun. I did jail ministry for a while, or jail AA meetings, whatever you want. My church likes to call it jail ministry. I'm like, whatever. I went to AA in jail. And if you've never done that, AA in jail, not jail, but I highly recommend it. I heard a lady say one time that when the ladies would say to her, you know, "I appreciate you coming here, but why do you do this?" She told them, she said, "You know, I did a lot of things that I should have gone to jail for and didn't. You're doing my time for me, so that's why I come here." And that really was such a huge blessing. And I forgot to even share with my husband, you know, this, the jail that I was going to was in Cartersville, And like I said, we live in Rockmart, which is only about 25 miles, I guess, from Cartersville. We were at a little restaurant. It didn't look anything like Cheesecake Factory. So, little Barrio Barbecue in downtown Rockmart the other day. And our waitress, she just kept smiling at me. You know, every time she'd come over, she'd just smile. And when we got ready to leave, she came up and she said, "I don't want to embarrass you, she said, "I just wanted to thank you." She said, a couple of years ago, I had to go to jail for a period of time, and she said, "I came to your AA meetings there," and she said, "You really blessed my life." And she said, you know, and I mean, I'm not saying that that's what got her back on track, but she's out of jail and she's working, and she got her daughter back, and you know, all. And I was just like, thank you, God, you know, that you can work through this program and carry this message. And you know, for the longest time, I probably carried the mess more than I carried the message. You know, when you first get sober, you know, God help us, we know everything. I don't know if any of you suffer from that, but I remember going to a meeting in Columbia, South Carolina. It was my second week in the program, and I got to Columbia at 5:30. The show was at 8:30, 9 o'clock that night, and I got into town like right at 5:15, saw that there's a meeting at 5:30, called. They said it's on Broad River Road, and I said, "Well, I'm on Bush River. Which way do I turn when I get to Broad River?" They said, "I don't know." I was like, "You don't know where the meeting's at?" "Yeah, I know where it's at, but I don't know if you turn right or left. When you get there, just go look for the street address." So I get down there, and I'm just stressing out because it's 5:30, and I'm trying to find the meeting. And if I'd have just stopped, or if I'd have just prayed, or if I'd have just looked, you know, I'd have seen a puff of smoke coming from right up. It was right there, you know, right there. And I take a left, and I get into all this traffic. So now I'm late getting it. So they've already read how it works and all this stuff. And the smokers were outside. So I sit down, and I'm, you know, I'm late, and it's their fault, you know. And I'm going to make sure somebody knows it's not my fault that I'm late. And so we get through the meeting, and they did the format of where you share, and then you call on somebody that you want to hear from. Well, nobody wanted to hear from me. You know, nobody called on me, and I'm 8 days sober, so I had so much to share. And so much wisdom. These people don't even know about my stalker yet. I've got to tell them about my stalker. So at the end of the meeting, the woman that was chairing the meeting, I said, "Are you in charge?" And she was like, "Yeah." It's like, "Well, I just wanted to tell somebody that I called the intergroup office at 5:15, and if they had told me how to get here, I would have been here on time. I just wanted somebody to know that. They need to have some directions, tell people from out of town to get to the meetings." And God love her, she just looked at me and she goes, "You ain't been sober very long, have you?" My head spin around like, 8 days, why do you ask? She's like, "Do you know who runs our intergroup?" "No, I'm not from here." She said, "A bunch of drunks like me." And I was like, "Oh, okay." And I was thinking earlier, one of the things I love about AA, there's so many paradoxes. And only in AA could you have the long form of the traditions. And second tradition is 21 words, and the short form is 31 words. What's up with that? You stick around here, you'll notice stuff like that. And one tool that I was given that hit me a while ago, because I'm having to really practice some of this stuff right now, is that somebody told me a long time ago that, you know, this is how it works, and this is why it works, and the promises are when it works. You know, that they come true when it's working in your lives and in our lives. And they told me to put my name, substitute my name in the traditions. And it kind of helps because my name rhymes with AA. But for Kay's purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in her life. You know, one of the ones that Kay's primary purpose is to carry AA's message to the alcoholic who still suffers. One of my favorite ones is Kay ought never be organized. One that I need to practice right now on a daily, minute, hourly basis is Kay has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, Kay's name ought never be drawn into public controversy. But those are just some of the tools that have helped, you know, that have helped me. And just by the grace of God, you know, if I stay sober one day at a time between now and September 10th, it'll be 13 years since I had a drink, you know. I mean, that's hard. That's only by the grace of God and the fellowship of this program. And, you know, sobriety is, you know, it's not a day at the beach, you know. I mean, yeah, it is. There's a lot of, I always tell people, you know, when people say life is not a rose garden, yeah, it is. It's got a lot of beauty and it's got a lot of thorns and it takes a lot of crap to fertilize it. And this past year, you know, my family has been through some stuff, and but we have not gone through it alone. My husband fell off a ladder in November of 2006 and broke his foot, and he's a diabetic, and his foot wouldn't heal, and he ended up having 7 surgeries in 11 months' time, and breaking his foot saved his life. You know, he was a heart attack. He'd already had 2 heart attacks and didn't even know it. He was a heart attack or a stroke waiting to happen. And just by just a fluke of missing one step, broke his foot, and it revealed all of this. And he was able to get all of this fixed, and how, you know, people showed up with food on our doorstep and with aluminum foil and paper towels and toilet paper and AA, you know, people and church people and just people in our community, the store where we do our business with gas and stuff. They took a collection. It paid our house note 1 month. You know, it's just seeing God work. We heard an AA speaker recently say that so many people debate, there's such a debate going on whether God exists. You come here, you get to see God work. You know, you get to see God working in people's lives. And, you know, it's just, this is the deal. You know, you just stay sober one day at a time. I've heard it said, you know, how do you get 20 years, don't drink and don't die, you know, just keep coming back. And no matter what, relapse is not a requirement. You know, you do not have to pick up another drink. If you do, that's okay. It's not okay when you die from it. You know, that's the only time picking up another drink is not okay. If you did it, get back here, do it again. We'll help you. Just, you know, just keep coming back. And I just thank God for all of you, and thank you for letting me share. Night.
Now I've heard her story twice, and very little bit of it was at the same both times, except wiping the tears from the corner of my eyes. Thank you, Kay. Thank you very much.